on radio. Hundreds of years ago, when the area we now know as Vermont was still a smoldering pastiche of hot-to-the-touch rocks, trees were academically porous, and kelp had not yet been invited to sit at the table of the magnetically primitive countryside, music was a new concept, as foreign to the charred community as were, say, eels to the school of beleaguered haberdashery. Yet, even in those prehistorically maroon times, musical uplinks and downloading were occurring at a frenetic pace in an effort to get life as we know it off to a tuneful beginning. Tonality and harmony were critical pieces to the early hominids' puzzle of survival, and those bipeds who could hum at length were usually given the status of tribal leaders, often with a big house thrown in if they could be occasionally persuaded to stop. Thumb and gander wars were sometimes fought over Bettina swooned as the district attorney held the red-stained tablecloth up for the jury to see.
I couldn't help it, she sobbed. He came at me with a catalog the size of a Buick and began to quote girths and quantities, brindle changes and extant tariffs. I told him I couldn't afford the service, but he laughed. He just laughed.
And here Bettina laughed too, a thin, hollow snigger that, under different circumstances, might give humor a bad name.
So I hit him. I hit him with my lapel-o-meter. Hit him so hard he fell into the sea,
which wasn't easy as we were 100 miles inland.
And that's where, to my horror, he became entangled in a web of kelp and became brunch for a band of hungry rogue kippers. That's what really happened.
And I have no... Suddenly, she spied a familiar face in the gallery and shrieked. A man covered from head to toe with hats stood up and bolted for the exit. An expert witness attempted to prevent his escape, but he bowled him over. The courtroom erupted in a fiery, volcanic explosion, and lava began to flow from where the bailiff's chair used to be. Bettina leaned over to the judge and... I'm sorry, I seem to be reading from the wrong page. This has been an excerpt from an out-of-print and as-yet-unpublished story entitled A Bag of Haggis by an occasional contributor to this program, Le Flambeau Orange.
Le Flambeau Orange.
The story will be read in its entirety on a future program, writes the author, speaking anonymously, unless members of the radiophonic audience telephone the studio today in unprecedented numbers. The numbers 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, and 5 have already been used and are thus precedented. Only numbers 6 and above are acceptable. As a good faith gesture, the sixth caller will win a lovely prize, compliments of the author. If you don't know the number, guess. And speaking of the future is now for episode 36 of Calvos and Damien's New Mosaic Sesquihour, this portion of which is being scientifically extruded for use on a future show that will examine ontological ramifications on listening audiences, especially during the part that features the best of the Sesquihour, Mark 7, to be heard later on the show, in which episodes 31 through 35 are auditorily pulverized into 6.5 minutes of the easiest imaginable listenable snippets. I don't make this stuff up. I only work here, as does this other guy. This other guy, guy by the name of...
Guy. By the name,
name of...
Guy.
By the name of... Calvos. And there's our first call.
Our first caller.
Yes, one down.
Five to go.
Yes, and you are listening to the Calvos and Damien New Music Sesquihour. And on it, you are currently listening to an excerpt to from John Zorn's Spillane. We'll listen to the rest of that short, or another 2 minutes of that, and we'll be back. Excerpt from John Zorn's Spillane, the long version of which is long.
Yeah.
It is indeed. We have got a terrific show today, and in the next, at least the next month, we've got Carl Stone as our guest today.
He's here for all month?
No, just for today, but it might feel like all month, depending on how you view the interview. He'll be here for an hour and 23 minutes, as it were. And we have a list of guests as long as my arm, maybe as long as yours, depending on how long your arm is. Larry Spiegel will be our guest in about 2 months. Charles Dodge, Randall Neal, Barbara Wells, Ken Sybesma from the Midwest, Jaron Lanier will be here. The inventor of virtual reality will be here via the telephonic medium. Mark Lindsay from the West Coast, David Stevens from London, John Bussey from Australia, Bob Wignes from Burlington, and Elma Miller from Toronto. Dr. Nerve will be here. Nick Didkoski will be here. Robert Train Adams, Richard DeCosta from Maine, Bill Gilliam also from Toronto, and Jim Lynch from Seattle. And Pauline Oliveros, one of the premier composers of this century, will be here in May. So that's the upcoming list. And then next week, Susan Bettman. And on the 17th of February, David Krause.
Wow.
All
and probably here at the same time?
Wouldn't it be nice to have everybody here at once? We could have a great simultaneous performance. It could go on for 24 hours. What was I saying?
You were saying something about...
Look us up on the Internet. You can get our playlists there, hear about all our guests, see pictures of them, see pictures of us. Look up New Music Vermont using the web crawler, and you'll find our site. What now?
Were you planning to play the...
Some music, you mean?
I don't know why.
What am I going to play? I'm going to play something by Jaron Lanier first.
What happened to the...
Mozart?
Versus Haydn.
We'll play that at the end of the show.
Oh, good.
Let's do a little Jaron Lanier, who'll be on our show. This is a piece in his new CD called Instruments of Change, and this is called. I got it here somewhere. It's called Cream Soda. from Instruments of Change by Jaron Lanier. Doesn't sound like too much change on that particular cut, but some of the things are easy. That was interesting. That was called Cream Soda. And we have caller number four.
Oh, could
we're
this
still
be
going
caller?
For the prizes. So caller number four is doing it right now. We have a great interview today with it is caller number four. We have a terrific interview today with Carl Stone, and it's a fairly long interview, so we're gonna start it right off.
But keep those calls and letters coming.
Yes, 454-7762. We want to hear from you. We want to hear what you think of what we've been doing, because we've been on the 36 weeks now we've been doing this.
Can it be?
Can it be?
Holy cow, another caller.
Well, while he's picking up that other caller, we're going to run for you our interview with Carl Stone, who is telephonically here, and we can't wait to have you hear what Carl Stone had to say. It's Calvos and Damien's New Music Sesquihour once more on the telephonic road, on the audio superhighway out to the west, the Eisenhower Interstate of telephonic communication.
Not me. I'm still here in the studio.
Well, I'm squeezing my way on the wires, and it sure is comfy. Our guest today on the show is Carl Stone. Welcome.
Hi.
Hi. What are you doing out there? What's the weather?
Well, it's rainy here, but I dare say it's warmer than where you are.
Not necessarily, because
well,
it's raining
about,
here.
It's in the mid-50s here. What have you got there?
You win.
We're up to 60, I think,
oh, yeah.
Climbing.
Yeah, in this room anyway, and raining. So, Carl, you are, how can I say this, probably the best known of the least known composers.
I take that as a compliment, I guess.
It is. Your work is groundbreaking, supposedly. Now, I put it that way because it has an accessibility which almost denies groundbreakingness.
Mm-hmm.
So what are you up to?
Well, I first of all, accessibility or inaccessibility are things that I personally don't really give that much thought to. I mean, I make the music that I make, and if people find it interesting or enjoyable, then that's great. If they find it oblique and obscure, I guess that's okay, too. I'm really sort of writing for myself, while I'm very happy if people enjoy it, it's not really the main reason why I create. So I guess, if I've been referred to as being groundbreaking, I don't know. I do use technology as part of my whole musical process, and that may be why some people think I'm onto something new. And I do use sampling, and that's, sort of in the whole musical history, a new phenomenon, although there are a lot of precedents there.
Well, it's a new phenomenon, not so much, or it seems not so much in pop, because we hear it so much now, but I think it certainly doesn't follow any traditions or trends that we can point to in the other side. And you don't like the sides. I know you don't like the sides, so I'm going to bring that up right now. Where are you in this?
I'm going to disagree with you
about
that there aren't really historical precedents to sampling. I think that that's not really the case. When I talk about sampling, by the way, I'm talking about the use in usually a collage fashion of musical material, not necessarily by myself, but maybe familiar musical material from another musician or composer or whatever.
Ah, theft.
Well, you can call it that, in which case you're going to be accusing a lot of people, not only people in the music world, but people in the visual arts and so on as being thieves. In music, there are a lot of precedents to the use of appropriated musical material, going back to as early as Bach and Beethoven, Handel. All those guys borrowed from the vernacular music. They also borrowed from each other. I mean, all you have to do is look at something like the Brahms Variations on a Theme by Handel or Variations on a Theme by Haydn. That's a kind of musical sampling in that he's doing what I'm doing. He's taking familiar musical material and doing arrangements, permutations, variations on that. And that's really all that I do.
We thought that with your predilection towards naming your pieces after restaurants that you tended to sample the buffet bar.
Well, I do name my pieces after restaurants, but it's just a completely, it's just a dumb idea that I had a few years ago. I got tired of trying to think up either clever or meaningful names to my pieces, and I decided to just sort of come up with an arbitrary system for naming my pieces. I could have, used a numbering system or some other kind of system, but I just thought that, these restaurants that I was going to, they were usually ethnic restaurants, and they usually had kind of exotic names like Chow Praya or Sukhothai or something like that. Didn't mean anything to me, I didn't think that it would mean much, literally to most of the people in my audience. So it was just a kind of way of combining two obsessions that I have. One is musical, and the other is culinary.
Not knowing your entire output, have you written Taco Bell yet?
I always confine my titles to restaurants that I like.
Ah.
So that would by its very nature, eliminate Taco Bell.
Oh, fine, a snob.
Our obsession on the show is always music and food, too, because we always wonder whether the people who come to the show are going to bring the buffet with them. They haven't yet done that. We've had to bring our own jelly donuts. Anyway.
We did have a request for a buffet Saint Marie, but we haven't been able to play her yet.
Ouch.
Ooh.
Ouch.
Ooh, ooh, ooh. Are you... Well, let's listen to something first. I think that's a good idea. Let's get a flavor of what you did.
Gosh,
about 10 years ago. And this was from your, when I use the word groundbreaking, apparently those of us on the East Coast were to learn some of the new music composition on the West Coast based on this original CD, CD Four Pieces.
Mm-hmm.
And it's kind of become a classic since then. And we're going to listen to the first cut on that.
Okay.
And say that one for us.
It's called Wall May Do.
Wall May Do. And again, a restaurant?
Yes, it's a now defunct Korean restaurant in Los Angeles.
Great. Let's listen to it. By Carl Stone, Wall May Do. Thank you. You're listening to the Calvos and Damien New Music Sesquihour on
WGDR
Plainfield. Wall May Do by Carl Stone. A very energetic piece, a very dancey piece. And again, turning back to this, the whole question of how, where you are in the spectrum of music. And I ask that because, you know, Damien and I both have a sort of categorization dilemmas about ourselves, because we don't know where any of us fit. I wonder if this is sort of an affliction of composers who are often self-taught. You aren't you?
No, I'm not self-taught.
I thought you were largely self-taught.
I studied classical music as a performance when I was young.
Yeah.
And then I attended the California Institute of the Arts and studied composition and electronic music techniques there. What my main teacher was Morton Sabat.
Oh, well, that's the same as being self-taught.
No, I thought that you were sort of self-directed during that period of time.
Well, that's true. I mean, I was kind of independent and worked on my own projects and was kind of cranky, actually, about following the directions of the class, but the CalArts was a pretty loose place, and they fortunately gave me that kind of freedom. Categorization is it's definitely an issue, and it's really a problem. I think it's only a problem in the minds of the marketers and the record stores, though. I mean, I don't know, when I go into a record store when I'm looking, say, to see if they have my own CDs, I don't know if I should look in the classical section or in the experimental avant-garde section, or in the noise section where it sometimes shows up, or if there's a new age section, occasionally it shows up there. Because these days there's so much work falling between the lines, crossing categories, that eventually all these kind of classifications become more or less meaningless.
Well, when they become meaningless, how do we begin to listen to the music? I mean, there's a multiplicity of components. It's not just a sort of an auditory one. There's kind of an understanding one as well to most of the music we hear in one level or another. Do you sort of not care about that level, or do you not want to give anybody anything other than the sonic ladder to work with?
Well, I want people to kind of listen on their own terms and without regard to what category they think it might or might not fit into. I guess that's the point. It seems to me that it's kind of like what I was saying before about titles, why I didn't like to name, give my piece fanciful titles, because it would sort of predispose people to listening in a certain way. And I wanted people to kind of approach my music always with an open mind and provide their own sort of mental dreamscape or picture to it. And so I guess that's sort of what I'm saying when I say that categories are really kind of irrelevant. You just sort of, you simply abandon all thought of whether this is minimalism or this is post-minimalism or this is pre-maximalism or anything like that, and you just listen.
It does absolutely draw you in. We have played Xing Qi on the program, and the reaction to it, we had callers who thought it was an extraordinary piece.
Well, that's nice to know.
Yeah, you're very modest about that particular piece. I wrote an email to you, and I called it a masterpiece, which I truly believe it is. And you were sort of, oh, well, gee, thanks, kind of response to that.
Well, what can I say? Oh, all right, you're right. It's a masterpiece.
Good, good. To which I read this one sentence written by a reviewer in Hopshin magazine who said, whatever it is that Stone does, no one does it better.
Well, that's nice, too. That's those kind of things, are very nice to hear.
Let's listen to another piece.
Great.
Let's do Gadberry's.
All right.
And it's when we first played it, we thought, Cadbury's. And that was our first clue that maybe we were talking food.
Mm-hmm. Cadbury's is a barbecue shop in Los Angeles.
We're bringing it forward in time here a little bit. This is, what, about 4 years after Walnut Me Do?
Cadbury's was done not quite 4 years, about three, but several years later.
That has definitely has a different feel. Let's listen to it. By Carl Stone, this is Cadbury's.
Gadberries by Carl Stone, a composition from 1989. How do you put together something like that? I think most of our listeners have had some background in how the instrumental people work and even how some of the New Age people work with MIDI equipment and so forth. How do you put something together?
Well, technically, or how I approach it sort of compositionally or aesthetically?
All of the above. Let's, we have plenty of time.
Okay. Well, basically, I very often approach a piece of music as, in the early stages, as a kind of play. And by play, I mean, really mean just kind of what you might call screwing around with a particular idea or a particular technique or something. And without any specific idea as to where I'm going to end up, without any, you know, predisposed idea about form or content or anything. And that's true in the case of Gadberries. I did a little programming on my computer to generate some of these, you know, rhythmic patterns and put in the pitches. And then I just sort of turned it on and let it happen for a while. And as it was happening, I sort of grew to understand what was going on. And I tweaked it a little, and I sort of then began to shape it and form it into something. And it was all, you know, pretty intuitive. As I say, I didn't really have a fixed idea of what I was looking for, and so I just kind of let the music lead me around, and I you know, exerted my hand once in a while, and that's really how it ended up. I use for the tweak heads, the gear heads in the audience.
Yeah, okay.
I used a Macintosh program called M to get the whole thing started, and M is a what's known as an algorithmic music program, because it actually, it's not like a sequencer where you kind of put in all the notes and then you hit a button and then they all get played back.
Right.
And you know. Sequencers obviously have a lot more capabilities than that, but that's basically, they function as kind of a glorified tape recorders using computer data instead of tape.
Right.
Well,
we did have Joel Chatterby on last week, and he'd explained how he did some of that.
Okay. Well, Joel Chatterby is the person who developed M.
Yeah.
So
I thought Fritz Lang had it.
For your listeners who tune in every week, it might be redundant, but in case anyone missed Joel,
sure.
I mean, basically M looks at a stack of pitches, and it looks at a stack of rhythms, and it just figures out, and this is, you know, oversimplifying it greatly, it just sort of figures out all the different combinations and gives them to you, and you can sort of train it to do certain things, and you can limit it and sort of focus it in one, you know, part of the musical world or another, but that's all you're doing, and that's really what Gadbury's is about.
So you are heard from what I've read. You're heard a great deal in Japan and not as much in America. Why is that?
Why is that?
Does it have to do with the technology?
Or the restaurants?
Does it have to do with the technology, or Damien said, or the restaurants?
I think that it is true. For some reason, I have a kind of enthusiastic following over in Japan. Not a huge following, but as I say, kind of enthusiastic one. And so I've been fortunate that I've been able to do, you know, numerous projects over there, and I've gotten, you know, a fair amount of attention and so on. Why that is, I don't know. I don't think it's as much because I'm using technology as maybe, and I would hope this to be true, I think more musical reasons. For some reason, I think the Japanese like what I was my approach, and what I was talking about earlier, is the kind of bring your own dream to the concert and supply your own mental images. The Japanese listen very intuitively, in fact.
They're very different from Western listeners. This is not, the European tradition does not cut it that?
Well, of course, there are a lot of people who are interested in Western classical music and European-based music. It's not to say that that's not understood, but I think that, you know, there are other ways of listening, and that some of the Japanese, anyway, seem to like my way or the way that I suggest to them. So I feel kind of fortunate that, you know, to have fans over there and the opportunity to go over there. I like Japan. I can sort of, you know, find my way around, speak a little of the language, and I've got a lot of friends over there now. So
let's listen to the masterpiece.
Okay.
Let's listen to Shinki, because let me just sort of, from my own perspective, say that I found that to be one of the few pieces that actually attempted, it seemed, to suspend time, that actually succeeded in doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I have lived through my share of stasis music and minimalist music, and I have written my share, believe me, we have all written our share of this stuff, and it is rarely successful when you get more than a year or two away from it. This mm-hmm. piece goes back half a decade or more, and
when I think about it, it's now 10 years old.
It's 10 years now, okay.
Yeah, it's 1986 that I wrote that piece.
Oh, yeah, I'm living in the past myself, I guess.
Wow, but that makes me shudder. Where did it go all this time?
Really?
Wow.
But it is captivating and gripping, and it is, you cannot get out of it. It pulls you into it. Just quickly, technically, what are we hearing? We're hearing a 19th century song sung 15,000 miles from home.
It's a song from Schubert's Winterreise, sung in English by a Japanese pop singer.
An amazing transformation has taken place.
Well, and it's really, yes, it was amazing, and that's what attracted it. Me to it when I heard this on a CD. The singer is named Akiko Yano, and she's basically a pop singer who put out this interesting kind of collection of art songs on a Japanese label, and I heard this, and I was really, there was one phrase that really stuck out from this whole, I liked the whole CD, but this one phrase really stuck out, and so I said, I've got to sort of get in, and I want to explore this phrase, I want to see how it works, I kind of want to get in at the atomic or molecular level and really see what's going on. And so the technique I use is a kind of time stretching, and by, you know, you take a phrase of music and you stretch it out, you can really sort of get in and examine it, and that's really kind of what I'm doing there.
how much, just quickly, how much original material was there? I mean, what length of time, if you were to take the actual snippet of the recording that you used, how much was there?
Well, it's probably about 12 seconds, maybe, altogether. They're basically, there's one phrase which is bisected, and then the first half of the piece uses the first half of the phrase, and the second half of the piece uses the second half of the phrase. And this is actually one of my most formal pieces, although I started doing it in a kind of theoretical way. It has, I think, probably the most rigid forms of any of the pieces that I've done in a while.
Let's hear it. Our listeners should put on their headphones or close their eyes or something so that they are not otherwise distracted by the world around.
Yeah, it's good to listen to in the dark. Did we say the name of the piece is Shinki?
We did.
Okay.
Shinki.
Shinki.
By Carl Stone. Ching Ki by Carl Stone. You were described at one point as a very user-friendly composer. That piece is not so much friendly, it seems to me, as it is demanding and like a siren, an enchantress mm-hmm. that will not let you go.
That's nice. Thank you.
Do you have a day job?
No, I'm a full-time composer. I've managed to sort of eke out a modest living as a composer, and I'm sort of proud to say that I've never taught in university. I've never had a university teaching position.
Not an academic sheet.
I've never done a Hollywood soundtrack, so I feel blessed.
Yes, go ahead.
How are the rates over to Japan? I mean, do you have a lot of frequent flyer points by now?
Well, yeah, as a matter of fact, I do. That's helpful, too. And I guess I was also sort of helped out the whole situation in Japan by the fact that the dollar has been pretty weak in comparison to the Japanese yen, and so that's been kind of accrued to my benefit, I have to say.
Are all of the titles of your pieces for restaurants in America, or are you international?
Most of them are American. A lot of them are from Los Angeles, where I used to live, and now you're starting to see some San Francisco restaurants and a few Tokyo restaurants, places like that.
But no Des Moines?
No Des Moines. I've never been to Des Moines, but I'm sure there must be some killer...
killer pig
corn restaurants.
Corn restaurants, yes.
Cornucopias.
We've played frequently music by... not frequently, but often enough for our listeners to remember, music by Conlon Nancarrow.
Mm-hmm.
And he was struggling with mechanical devices long before sequencers and synthesizers were possible.
Mm-hmm.
What would you be doing without this?
Without my little computer?
Yeah.
Well, that's a good question. I mean, I've been interested in technology of one form or another since the late 1960s, so it's hard to imagine not using some form of technology. I mean, I did a lot of work with tape and in the recording studio long before computers were really practical for, you know, people like me. But if you, like, sort of stuck me in a desert island, unplugged, no electricity...
Yeah, right. If you were in the desert island or if for some reason the Star Trek time warp just sort of socked you back to 1945, you know, in Des Moines.
It's an interesting question, but I really don't know the answer. I mean, using a computer is pretty much fundamental to what I do. It's almost hard to imagine. But I guess... what can I say? What the results would be, I do not know. Would it stop me from composing? No. Because regardless of what I do, I always try to... I'm actually interested in limitations. I mean, I have a fair amount of equipment in my studio, but I, when I do a piece, I will usually say, okay, for this piece, I'm going to use this one piece of gear. I'm not going to use anything else. And I'm going to explore this one piece of gear. I'm going to, you know... It's a challenge. I'm going to limit myself to just maybe one aspect of this piece of gear, and really try to squeeze all the juice out of that lemon. And so, if I was, you know, on a desert island with just a bamboo flute or something, I guess I would start working on my embouchure and see what I could get out of it.
And try to plug it in.
Yeah. Right.
Let's listen to something else from a new CD, and then we'll get back with a couple more questions. Just a very shortcut from the new CD, Kamiya Bar.
Mm-hmm.
This is Guild.
All right.
A real short one. Let's listen to it.
We'd like to remind our listeners that this part of Calvos and Damien's New Music Sesquihour is being brought to you by this portion of Calvos and Damien's New Music Sesquihour.
You had something about titles. You were going to ask him about titles.
I wanted to ask him, but he's gone now.
He's gone. We'll get him back. We'll squeeze him back. He's through the lines. He was making roast beef.
Yeah, he was. I wondered if his titles are so arbitrary. I know that we particularly have a lot of input on, the titles have a lot of input on the piece, and they're rather important, but he doesn't seem to have such import attached to his titles.
But what? It means something.
What means what? Not what
the titles do something to you when you listen to the pieces.
Yes.
They do something to me, I don't know.
They make me hungry. They do? What pieces?
I don't know.
Who are we talking about, anyway?
I don't know. I have no idea who we're talking about.
Okay, I'm back.
Okay, we won't. Nothing we said matters. We can all edit that out. What, you have company?
No.
What you cooking?
I'm cooking roast beef a la Carl.
Oh, a la Carl. And why is it a la Carl?
Instead of a la Stone.
Roast beef a la mode de Bernal Heights. well, it's just it's actually nothing worth talking about.
Okay. Well, we've just heard Guild by Carl Stone. This is from your new CD, and having heard the whole thing a couple of times, it's very different from to my ears. These jumps from 85 to 90 to 95 are very, very different. I don't hear the progression. But before we talk about that, how the heck do you perform live?
My performance setup is pretty simple. I like to keep it simple because that sort of I really admire people like
Nelson Rockefeller.
A solo instrumentalist like a John Zorn can just sort of pick up a saxophone, hit the road, and go. My setup is not quite that simple. I have a PowerBook, a Macintosh PowerBook, and a sampler. It's a small one-rack space sampler made by a company called PV.
Oh, a little PV, okay.
And a synthesizer, and that's basically it. It's a small MIDI interface, and that's all I require.
So what's it look like when somebody watches you perform?
Well,
is the visual important?
I'm sorry?
Is the visual important?
Frankly, no.
Okay.
I have kind of de-emphasized the visual thing because there's not that much to see. I mean, I'm looking at a computer screen. I'm touching, actually, the keys of the computer. I don't have a keyboard or a drum kit or anything like that. These days I stand up and play. I used to sit at a table. In fact, once we thought about doing a concert where I'd be sitting at my computer and I'd be sort of staged, you know, with like a telephone and a desk calendar and some pens, and it would sort of be like Carl in his office. Basically, there's not a whole lot to see. I do sort of get into it and rock out, but I like to sort of turn down the lights and again sort of emphasize the sound as the component. I don't really go to concerts to watch people. I go to concerts to listen, and so that's kind of what I encourage other people to do as well.
So each performance is different.
Yeah, each performance. Oh yeah, definitely, sure, absolutely. Each piece is different, and each piece, I mean, some pieces are the same, one or two pieces are the same almost every time. Shinki is one of those. Some pieces are very, almost completely different every time. And a lot of pieces sort of fall in the middle where they're basically, they have a lot of similarities from one performance to the other, but a lot of details are different as well.
Quite a bit like eating at restaurants.
If you say so.
Depends on who the chef is that night, right?
Yeah.
Let's listen to Young Jump.
All right.
This is another brief section of a longer CD, Kamiya Bar, by Carl Stone, Young Jump.
Ma.
That's what I meant earlier, this piece, Young Jump, by Carl Stone. That's what I meant earlier when I said it was different from what I thought we'd heard before. What's the story behind this whole CD?
Well, this whole CD is called Kamiya Bar, and it's a piece of music that was composed, it was commissioned by the radio in Japan, FM Tokyo. And I had I'd lived in Japan on a grant, kind of cultural exchange program back in 1989. And I had a little DAT machine and a stereo microphone, and I would walk all around the city and try to just capture as many sounds as I could with the idea that at some point I would do something musical with it. And so this commission sort of gave me the chance. And basically many, if not all, but many of the sounds that you hear are samples from the city of Tokyo. It's a kind of urban portrait, sound portrait of Tokyo, which is a very, very special sound environment. So what you hear if you listen to Kamiya Bar, you hear the voices of the television and radio, you hear the right-wing politicians lecturing on the street, you hear the sounds of the train stations, you see hear the sounds of the fish auctioneers at the early morning fish auction near the bay, and you hear just, you know, a whole, the elevator girls, just a lot of different things. very disorienting to be in the middle of this kind of sound environment. And I tried to sort of capture that disorientation at times and also organize it at times and make it kind of more rational. It's in a way a sound portrait of Tokyo, and in a way it's just something else altogether.
What question should we have asked you? What's the question you most wanted to answer?
Well, I thought what's for dinner was pretty good.
Well, everybody's got a message, I think, sometimes beyond the actual art they create. You know, have you got one of those? Playing?
There are a bunch of questions which I am interested in being asked, but I don't have good answers for any of them.
Are you nearsighted or farsighted? Does your nose slope inadvertently to the left?
No.
Okay, there, that's a question.
That is a question.
Our audience wants to know.
Well, the thing is that, for example, as a creative person, I could have, I suppose, chosen to work with words, to be a writer or to be an architect or to be a visual artist, but for some reason I chose music, I chose sound. And I'm not sure exactly why that is. I mean, I guess I have nothing to do to explain that, is except to say that, you know, sound has always been the medium that communicated with to me more than any other. I'm not a particularly visual person, in fact. I love literature. I never ever seriously considered doing anything else but being a composer. That's not really a question. It's just, I don't even know what that means.
Have you considered politics? I think there's a trend for musicians to segue into politics.
Oh, yeah? For example?
Well, like John Zorn, for example. Isn't he in the White House right now?
Oh, that guy. Right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's an interesting point. There are a lot of composers who have tried to use music as a political tool or means to an end. I find those things generally don't work very well. But people try them.
Well, we're leading you astray here. I think we should listen to finish up the show today with one more piece of music. Cooking Papa.
All right.
Love that title.
By the way, all the titles from this is also from Kamiya Bar.
Right.
And in this case, I did use another arbitrary system for naming the sections of Kamiya Bar. And these are all named after comic books in Japan.
Ah, Cooking Papa.
Cooking Papa is a comic book.
I won't ask. It's a very, very, very collage-like feel to this one, to my ears.
Mm-hmm.
Rather than kind of a wovenness or a threadness, this one feels more like a pasting of many pieces and chunks together.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Did you head in that direction? What were you looking to do there?
I think the way you described it is pretty accurate. I mean, there are a lot of things going on. It's better if people just listen.
Okay, they will. Carl Stone, thank you very much for joining us today on Calvis and Damien's New Music Sesquihara. This has been great.
Thank you. It's been a lot of fun.
By Carl Stone, Cooking Papa from Kamiya Bar.
On the Calvis and Damien New Music Sesquihara on WGDR, Plainfield.
Thank you.
cooking Papa from Carl Stone's new CD, Kami Abar. That's on an Italian label called Roby Droli. And if you want to know where to get these things, look up New Music Vermont with your web crawler and find the Calvis and Damian New Music Bazaar. We got all the labels and all the playlists and everything right up on there, and excerpts from these interviews in real audio and little clips of music, and you can have a lot of fun at our website and look up New Music Vermont.
And speaking of New Music Vermont, or more readily speaking of excerpts, it's the best of the Sesqu day again. Yes, it's time to present the listenable snippets excerpted from the previous five episodes, made palatable to the ear bones in listenable snippet format. So sit back and relax, and here is the best of the Sesqui Hour Mark 7. No. Here it is. The next portion of Calvos and Damian. Decaferbers and Kilotunes. I had entered a bad dream. Like ringing in the ears. Like ringing in the ears. Like ringing in the ears. Like ringing. But.
Oh!
The haberdasher smiles, and two-thirds of the Fennel Barbershop Quartet, which was Thursday. They shake hands. What does it mean?
What do you think?
Bye.
And are they still singing? Because really, it's not perfect unless it's explicated.
Le Flambeau Orange, where he gave birth to Nadia Boulanger.
Sweet comic Valentine.
The best, no kidding, the best of the Sesquihour Mark 7.
That was best.
That was best. Presented in listenable snippet format for your Saturday afternoon pleasure. Tune in again in 5 weeks, but don't stop tuning in between now and 5 weeks. But in 5 weeks, we'll have the best of the Sesquihour Mark 8.
Or maybe a repeat of one of the earlier ones, depending on where we are. Okay, yeah, wow, that was the best. That was really, when are you going to do the best of the best, after a year?
I keep telling you that one of these days we'll have a best off.
A best off.
The Mark 1 will...
The Betty Crocker best off.
Yes, could be.
All right, the Sesqui Crocker best off. We got a birthday? You said we have a birthday, a Mozartian birthday?
Oh, right, it's old Wolfie.
Wolfie. Yes. Well, you know, we can't play Mozart on this program.
No, he wouldn't be on the show anyway. Yeah, we can't have two guests.
No, that's true. That's true, and I'm sure Carl Stone would take precedence in every opportunity over Mozart.
He was
Mozart.
President now?
Yes,
Carl Stone was president. I know we didn't mention running for politics.
John Zorn and Carl Stone were president.
They're the same person.
They are.
All right.
Alfred Schnittke.
Was also president.
Yes, and we are going to play, since we can't don't dare have the old Wolfie Mozart himself on the show, we're going to play his Alfred Schnittke's game with music for two violins called Mozart a la Haydn.
Let's get to it.
You want to get to it?
Right.
Like right away?
Sure.
Okay, Mozart a la Haydn. That's Gideon Kramer on the violin and the conductor, and Tatiana Gridenko on the other violin. Music by Alfred Schnittke. Thank you.
Thank you.
celebrating the birthday of Mozart with as much enthusiasm as possible for this show. That's Mozart a la Haydn by Alfred Schnittke.
A production of Multimedia.